Hello again, my wonderful audience. I hope you all are finding your courage and standing up for freedom and joining the great movement that's going on throughout America. And here is one of the heroes of all that's going on out there, Dr. Elizabeth Lee Valeat, MD, a physician. And she has two places in my life. We're glad to have her as a potential physician whenever we need her. What a blessing. But she's available also to all of you. And she is the founder and director of Vive Life Center. That's V-I-V exclamation point, Life Center. You can get to her by basically going for her name, Elizabeth Lee Valeat, V-L-I-E-T. And she does hormone connections and solutions for men and women. She's really a great doctor and a solid citizen to boot. Now, much like me and her friend, Dr. McCullough, my friend, Dr. McCullough, and Zev Zelenko, who appeared on this show a number of times, as has Dr. Lee. She shifted a lot of her attention, but not all of it, but a lot of it to the lack of treatment she was seeing for COVID-19. And she was just appalled. She was one of the earliest people to come forward and say, you can't not treat people for viral diseases. And this is a virus respiratory disease. We know how to treat those, and people are treating it around the world. CDC, FDA, Fauci, you can't deprive Americans of the power or the right. And she was one of the very early people to begin writing blogs, essays about this. And since then, she's gone on to just work very closely with frontline doctors around the world. And she actually did the writing for the blue book that I'm constantly advertising to people. And it's free. And you can get the wonderful blue book on the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. You can go right to AAPS online or AAPS.com will get you there too. And you can learn how to treat COVID-19 and where to find doctors who are treating COVID-19. Do you do telemedicine too, Dr. Valeat, to treat yes. people?
Yes. Physicians were under the Trump administration. Many of the restrictions on telemedicine state by state were waived during the national emergency. And so there is more flexibility to provide consults by telemedicine than used to be the case. So yes, that's actually been good. And to mention the specific easy link for your listeners, www.covidpatientguide.com is a really simple way to get to the booklet that several of us were involved in writing as a layman's guide to early treatment and all of the medicines that are working so well to keep people out of the hospital and reducing the death rate.
And just now, Conan Milner, who's a wonderful writer on my favorite newspaper in the world, Epoch Times. If you want to get the real truth about what's going on in COVID-19 and particularly with what the relationships are with China, this is a newspaper founded by Chinese dissidents who had to leave China. And it's just filled with useful information. And this week, Dr. Valeat was quoted in a good Epoch Times article, and it's spelled E-P-O-C-H, Epoch. I'm saying it that way, not because I don't know what the dictionary says, but so that you'll know how to spell it. And they quote Dr. Valeat extensively on the treatment of early COVID-19. Now, I would say Lee Valeat and I are at the least friends and dear friends. And she's done a lot for me, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. But I was very proud to see you being covered in the Epoch Times, because I had a long-standing relationship with Conan Milner, and I made sure he got to know you, and got to know Dr. Peter McDougall as well. And
Conan did a great job. He is very thorough as a investigative reporter in getting the background on the subjects that he's looking into, which I appreciate, because so many times today we see reporters not doing their homework and just parroting things they hear elsewhere. And we need responsible journalism in our country right now. Americans need to know the background and need to know reliable information to make decisions.
That is so true so well put. And something else that I hope Dr. Leet will be very proud of eventually is she's had a wonderful impact on our book, Ginger and My Book, which is in the process of coming out, COVID-19 and the Global Predators. And she is probably the only person who's really, really taken some responsibility for just reading that whole darn book and giving me tons and tons of advice, so much that I yelped at times, but always good advice and always thoughtful advice. And I want to say in public, it's a much better book because of your very hard work in going through it. And I'm going to just tell you how to get that book, and then we're going to go to talk about more about Dr. Leet's work in helping people medically with the sometimes normal and sometimes abnormal changes we all go through when we're older. And the book that Ginger and I are finishing up now can be bought in advance by going to We are the prey. And if you have trouble spelling prey, P-R-E-Y, Ginger, in her brilliance, has made it possible for you to get there if you misspell it too. And so wearetheprey.com. And there you can get the book at a very reasonable reduced rate. It'll probably be available in May or it'll be available in May or June. But I've done something. I'm not even sure. Well, I do know how I got the idea. I just didn't like people having to wait for this information. And so I took a flyer, really, and talked to Ginger about it. And the moment you sign up for the book, you go Bing and you order the book, in your mailbox will appear a recent version of the whole manuscript as a PDF. You will be able to look up and read about the basic information. Sure, the book will be a little more polished for sure, and the book will have some pieces of new information in it, but you'll get the gist. You'll get the meat and the heart of what's going on in this country in every aspect of COVID-19. Everybody seems to agree it's the most comprehensive of all the books. And Dr. Leet was kind enough, in addition to all the other work she did, to write a brief introduction for it, along with brief introductions from Dr. Zelinsky, Zev Zelinsky, who was the first doctor to really stand up and say, this is a viral disease. I've talked to doctors around the world. I've been reading the literature. We know how to treat it. I'm going to treat it. And he did treat it. And he's paid a big price, but if you watch his videos with me on Dr. Breggin's YouTube channel, you'll see what a great man he is and how much strength he's gotten from God and all of this. And then a third introduction is done by Peter A. McCullough. And so that's my triumvirate of introducers who are at the top echelon of frontline treatment. So I'm just really grateful to you, Lee. And let's go on now and look at your work. Maybe talk about how you got into it, what it is. I know that it is useful medicine. You're doing good work.
Well, thank you, Dr. Bragan. And I do want to say for your listeners, I think actually it's critically important and potentially life-saving for everyone listening to read your book. It is one of the most in-depth and powerful books outlining what has really happened with the COVID pandemic. So many people say it doesn't make sense and things are not adding up. And I think you did, and you and Ginger just did a phenomenal job of the research of connecting the dots of how all of these disparate pieces that weren't making sense, how that connected. And when you describe the global predators and we are their prey, that's exactly what's been happening to innocent people around the world. So I think that is critically important. And there's an interesting parallel to the way that you and Ginger connected the dots on the COVID pandemic to the work that I've been doing since the early 80s in medicine in connecting the dots.
Yes.
Of what wasn't making sense in our fragmented medical model where we treated people by body part and by specialist instead of looking at how the human body was designed and created and how we work as an integrated functioning organism as a whole. And even using the term holistic medicine is not adequate because so many of the people who practice what they call holistic medicine are actually doing very symptom-based treatments using natural medicines in the same methodology of treating symptoms that they accuse Western medicine doctors of doing using pharmaceutical agents instead of getting to the underlying causes of particular problems. And one of the things that led me into this work very early in my career, when I was teaching in family medicine in Norfolk, Virginia, at Eastern Virginia Medical School, where I had graduated from medical school and done internal medicine there, and then went on to Hopkins for further training in psychiatry, neuroendocrinology, and behavioral medicine. And I actually had been recruited back to the Department of Family Medicine to set up a mind-body medicine program curriculum for the family medicine residents to teach them the broader aspects of human beings and illness and how who we are as a person can influence expression of illness and vice versa, and how our life stresses may influence disease development. So it was a connected and integrated program. But what was interesting was the residents kept sending me women patients and said, oh, they just have anxiety or depression. They got to go see Dr. Lee. I mean, the residents and those who are trained in medicine know how this works. Residents are wonderful at trying to turf patients off to somebody else to take care of. And so if they could find a way to refer the patient on to one of the attendings and get it onto my plate to take care of, they thought they had succeeded. And it was kind of funny. But what was interesting was many of the residents would say, okay, well, you're having anxiety, you're depressed, or you're not sleeping, or you have these migraine headaches, you got to go see Dr. Vliet. Well, 2 weeks later, I would see the woman, and it was women, which will become clear in a second, and they would be fine. And I said, well, wait a minute. this isn't a psychiatric disorder. If you were being moody and irritable and depressed and feeling bloated and headachy a week ago or 2 weeks ago, and suddenly you're fine. And so what was going on? Oh, well, that was the week before my menstrual cycle. And I always get like that. And I said, oh, okay. Well, that's not a psychiatric disorder that comes and goes every month with the menstrual cycle after women ovulate. So at that time, our medical school was the pioneer for the in vitro fertilization programs and infertility management. The first in the country was done at Eastern Virginia Medical School. And we had the world leaders right there. And so I had patients going through fertility treatment, and heaven knows any of your listeners that ever went through that know the dramatic mood swings that occur with all the hormone manipulation of an infertility treatment. So I'm treating patients who are going through that and having horrendous mood swings and headaches and all sorts of problems with these enormous hormone fluctuations. So I started applying those principles of checking hormone levels by cycle phase in women with PMS, women with menstrual migraines, women with menstrual related seizure disorders, for example. And lo and behold, I was using the same protocols that the fertility doctors were using. I was just using them for different purposes to get at different questions that we were trying to figure out for these patients. Well, as it turned out, the hormone fluctuations of the typical menstrual cycle affect everything from asthma outbreaks to migraines and seizures and multiple sclerosis flare-ups and pelvic pain flare-ups, all sorts of clinical problems that are very much influenced by the hormonal changes through the menstrual cycle or postpartum or perimenopause or after hysterectomy or tubal ligation. And the more that I began teasing apart the pieces of this puzzle, the more I realized that we really were practicing very fragmented medicine that did not address women's unique body chemistry very well, because the same medicines were applied in the same doses for men and women. And many of the studies were done based on 170 kilogram male without taking into account women's smaller body, higher body water content, different metabolic factors that affected drug metabolism. And so the more that I worked with all of that, the more I saw how medication doses of all kinds needed to be adjusted based on the menstrual cycle changes and how that affected drug metabolism. And the more I got into the international research on this, because more of this work was being done in Europe, Australia, and Scandinavia than was being done in the United States. And I started going to the international conferences where climacteric medicine, which is the study of endocrine systems and the aging impact from puberty through late life. And I began going to where the world leaders were presenting the research in this fascinating field. And then we come full circle to what was also interesting in our work at Johns Hopkins. We had an interdisciplinary team of physicians that was part of the sexual consultation program. And we were evaluating people from all around the world with various types of sexual function disorders. And what was interesting to me at the time, they always checked men's testosterone level as part of evaluating male sexual dysfunction, but they never checked women's hormone levels. And so it wasn't until several years later when we were learning from the fertility doctors about cycle-specific hormone testing in women, that I realized, what a terrible omission that was, because low estrogen levels affect women's entire brain body function in ways that no one was looking at. And certainly sexual response is part of that, but it's not the only thing. And one of the things, when people ask me very quickly, well, what's an example of your work? And I said, well, a good example of the fragmentation is migraine headaches. 80% of the sufferers of migraine headaches are female. The gender difference begins at puberty and ends at menopause. You think that might tell us a clue? And even Hippocrates, 2,500 years ago, observed that women before their menstrual bleeding had a greater tendency to have these migraine headaches. And women with, as they approached menopause and menses became scant, also had more migraines. So I started digging into the scientific research on that. Well, lo and behold, in 1975, a Dr. Somerville had done some studies looking at what was the trigger of migraine headaches that always started with the menstrual cycle or after ovulation, for example. And he found that it was the drop in estradiol with the onset of bleeding, not the drop in progesterone. And he did a pretty elegant study that showed conclusively which hormone was the culprit. And so I'm sitting there, instead of all of the narcotics they were using in those days to treat migraines, I started adding an estradiol patch for women who had menstrual migraines to keep their estrogen from dropping and preventing the trigger of the migraines. Well, women who'd been suffering from migraines for much of their adult life were just thought this was a miracle cure. And it was something so simple to do, but just like the war on hydroxychloroquine we've seen in 2020, there was a war on estrogen going on. And gynecologists would say, well, you can't do that. You can't put an estrogen patch on somebody who's premenopausal. Well, why not? If her estradiol level is dropping, and it's every month that it's dropping below where it needs to be, and it's triggering a migraine headache, why not just put a little parachute under her drop in estrogen and prevent it and stop the trigger and stop her from having to use all of these migraine medicines that are expensive, that have a lot of side effects and have their own risk. So anyway,
But the answer was contained in what you said, because we don't want to stop giving all the medicines that are expensive, and we don't really care about the side effects, and we don't even know it, but it's all been contrived by the pharmaceutical industry. And the guy who comes and brings me lunches from my whole crew on Fridays at the office, and so on and on and on. It's throughout medicine is this calculated pharmaceutical corporate make money on the drugs rather than helping people.
You know, that's so true. We get so focused on adding a medicine to treat every symptom. As I tracked my patients over the years, and I have over my career have seen patients from all over the country and from overseas. We had one of my books was translated into Russian. And I actually had a patient come from Moscow to my office in Tucson because she read my book, Women, Weight, and Hormones, in Russian. I never got a copy of it. I'd love to have seen the book printed in Russian. But it was really, it's staggering to me how much the connections have been overlooked. And my first book was called Screaming to Be Heard, Hormone Connections Women Suspect and Doctors Ignore. And that came out in 1994. There was an updated version that came out in hardback in the early 2000s, and it's now on Kindle. And that book has continued.
Repeat the title. We'll give people, again, just a time to think about the title.
Screaming to Be Heard, Hormone Connections Women Suspect and Doctors Ignore.
I think Screaming for Women and Dr. Vliet, V-L-I-E-T, will get them there. Go ahead.
Well, you know, the publisher is a New York publisher at the time, and he said to me, you know, Dr. Vliet, if you write that book with that title, the women are going to love it and the doctors are going to hate you. And they are going to read that book and they're going to try to discredit you. And I said, well, you know, George, I have been speaking to doctors groups for a long time and I've been teaching these concepts and I don't find a great deal of interest. And I think it's time to write for the women who want to know how to take care of their bodies and what's going on and what are some options, simple approaches they can use to help them feel better. So I wrote for the women.
Right on.
Which is also what I did when COVID came around. And what's fascinating is that all the years of work that I've been doing in the gender differences in various diseases and medication response set me up well to understand what we were seeing in the COVID pandemic, because the Italians very early on, February, March, Italy was just being slammed with COVID patients and high death rates. And the Italian hospitals and doctors, and I had a lot of friends in Italy among some of the colleagues I'd worked with in my field. And they were literally just being totally overwhelmed and devastated by the COVID with all the influx of Chinese from Wuhan, China, that live and work in the northern Italy area. Mm. And they were observing that older men were dying at higher rates of COVID than older women. And they were speculating that something had to do with women and the way that our immune system works differently. And that's exactly right. Women, there have been lots of studies on the differences in male and female immune responses. And women do have a more robust immune system, and that is influenced by our estrogen-based physiology. And what's fascinating is the same reason that contributes to women having a higher rate of autoimmune disorders is also related to a more robust immune system. And sometimes it gets out of control, and pregnancy can affect that as well. But older men who were also losing testosterone as they got older had some detrimental effects on their immune system as testosterone was declining, and older obese diabetic men have lower testosterone than non-obese men. So older men were getting a double whammy of the obesity, diabetes, insulin resistance that dropped testosterone and loss of their immune function as a result of that, and having a less robust immune system compared to women anyway. So I think there was a lot of interesting differences in the male-female death rates that were being reported from other countries in particular. But also what we're now seeing is that women are having higher rates of adverse reactions to the vaccines, in part because of a more robust immune response and a more intense inflammatory and blood clotting response. And I'm just shocked at how many of my patients went ahead and got the vaccine and have had some very serious neurologic complications, blood clotting complications. It's very alarming. And particularly women with existing autoimmune disorders like rheumatoid arthritis, I've been advising my patients with those conditions that they should think twice about getting the vaccine, because it's really ramping up the immune response in ways that can be quite detrimental if you already have an underlying autoimmune disorder. So again, the gender differences that I've been working with for my whole career are coming out again and again with the COVID pandemic in the response to the virus, in the response to the vaccines, and in responses to some of the medications that we're using.
It's very interesting. One of the more interesting talks I have heard in recent years was a talk at one of Pam Popper, who was a nutritionist, folks, and a friend. You've seen her on the shows, one of her conferences, and it was about research on the importance of nursing, which has so many importances. A whole show could be given about that, and maybe we should at some point. But one of the points was that the mother's milk on a maybe even minute to minute, but certainly hourly basis was producing, giving the child the antibodies to the local allergens that the mother was experiencing. So that the mother's, and I'm sure you know this better, much better than I do, but the mother's, and correct me, and so the mother's immune system had to be especially strong and especially rapidly responsive, because it was producing not only antibodies and whatever else is goes into that response for herself, but also for the vulnerable infant who had no prior exposures. So does that make sense as to where some of that strength?
Absolutely. And I think it's been clear from many studies over the years that the importance of that initial burst of colostrum in improving the baby's immune response, and the nursing, the ways in which the mother's immune system helps the child. And nutritionally, I don't think there's any question but what that's critically important. And we know a lot more about it even than when you and I were in medical school. In those days, but we know a lot more now about the science of just exactly how it works.
Yeah. I want to say, by the way, that Dr. Lee was in medical school much more recently than I was. I mean, thank you for lumping us together, but there's a quite considerable difference in when we were in medical school. Oh my gosh. Well, when I was in medical school at Case Western Reserve, we had two women in the class, and that was considered extraordinary. We had at least one African American, maybe two, and we had two women. And that was really unheard of at the time. That's how long ago it was, and how antediluvian the treatment of the women and African Americans was.
Well, there's a lot of truth to that. A lot of truth to that.
Is this a good time for you to switch to talking about men and how you got into that area? Because I want this to be a show for that part of your work as well. I want to learn. I want to sit here and learn, because I don't know anything about this.
Well, definitely. And actually, it was a lot of our work at Johns Hopkins that led to my early work was with men. And as I said, we had this whole interdisciplinary team of people working particularly on male sexual dysfunction. And at that time, there was not a lot of research. The Viagra class of medicines had not been invented. And there was not a lot of research on the medical causes of erectile problems in men. At the time, the common teaching, just like the common teaching is wrong today that there's no early treatment for COVID, the common teaching about male sexual dysfunction at that time was wrong. They were attributing 95% of the causes to psychological problems in men. And what the Hopkins team was very highly instrumental in identifying was the many medical causes of erectile dysfunction. Two big ones that were totally unrecognized until the Hopkins team really got working on the research on it was diabetes. Early diabetes, one of the earliest symptoms that can indicate diabetes or pre-diabetes is declining erectile function. But yet primary care doctors hardly ever talk about that with their male patients. men are getting older and fatter around the middle, the beer belly. People joke about it in men. Oh, boy, does he have a beer belly? He must really like his beer. Well, the problem is that that beer belly is a very insidious risk factor for not only heart disease and diabetes and back problems and back pain, but it also contributes to decline in free testosterone because all that visceral body fat is loaded with estrogen, and free testosterone is decreased. Men lose muscle mass, they lose their metabolic activity, they become more insulin resistant, and becomes a vicious cycle of developing more and more middle body fat, lower and lower testosterone, higher and higher diabetes risk, which goes along with vascular damage that clogs small arteries with plaque. And some of the penile arteries are the early ones that are blocked with plaque, which affects erection, because erections are primarily a neurovascular event. It requires good blood flow and it requires normal nerve function. Well, we all know that prediabetes and diabetes damage nerves and blood vessels. So it's not surprising that early diabetes symptoms can be changing loss of erections, loss of nocturnal erections, loss of morning erections, loss of rigidity so that penetration is difficult. And that's what the Hopkins team was looking at. They were also looking at the way in which sleep disorders affected nocturnal penile erections, because that needs REM sleep. Well, if your sleep is disrupted because you have a sleep disorder, then that's affecting sexual function as well. So our team was looking at all of those factors. And as part of our evaluation, we were looking at hormone levels. We were looking at metabolic measures. We were doing sleep studies. We were doing psychological evaluations, alcohol intake. I did a lot of work looking at the pharmacology of different medications that are used for blood pressure treatment, for example. And most of the medications used for blood pressure management, pain management, depression, and statins to lower cholesterol, all of these drugs have an adverse effect on sexual function. But cardiologists don't address sexual problems for men. So the cardiologists are working with the statins. And if a man is having sexual problems, he may talk to a urologist about that, but the urologist is not managing the blood pressure and the statin medicines. So there's a disconnect between getting the help they need to put the pieces together. And that's a lot of the consultative work that I do, is looking at all of the medicines someone is taking. How do the side effects of the medicines interact with each other? How do they contribute to vitamin deficiencies and metabolic problems? You know, if you push a cholesterol level too low in men, they can't make testosterone, because cholesterol is the building block that is needed for men and women's bodies to make these steroid hormones, estrogen and testosterone, for example. So when the cardiologists are working focused on getting cholesterol pushed below 150, that leads to the medical definition of hypogonadism, which is in men low testosterone, which in turn makes women and men at higher risk for prediabetes, diabetes, and heart attacks and strokes. So, and this is work that's been done in multi-center studies throughout the world. And some of my colleagues in Brussels have been sending me papers that have been done overseas and that are showing these connections, that just getting proper medication evaluation and restoring a man's testosterone levels to optimum ranges. Now, there's some problems with how you do that. And a lot of the testosterone clinics that have popped up all over the place are doing injectable testosterone and they're spiking the levels a little too high in many cases, which then creates other problems. But if testosterone therapy and replacement is done properly at physiologically normal levels, it improves diabetes risk, it improves the metabolic situation, lowers the risk of heart attacks and strokes. And actually, men with low testosterone are at higher risk of prostate cancer than men who have testosterone therapy properly done as they get older. And again,
that's so counterintuitive, you know.
Well, it's not, you know, it's not counterintuitive, Dr. Bragan. It's
well, actually, to the uninformed.
It's no, actually think about it. It makes sense that if prostate cancer is only occurring in older men.
Oh, of course. It's a response to the low testosterone. Of course.
It's counter to the prevailing medical teaching in the United States, because we've been not paying attention to what is happening with aging. And the U.S. medical model tends to think that we're the best in the world, and they don't look so often at other studies as they should. And so here are all these international studies that have shown for literally in the last 30 years that low testosterone in older men is associated with diabetes, prostate cancer, dementia, depression, stroke, loss of muscle mass, and increasing metabolic risk, metabolic syndrome. All of that has been in the literature for years, and yet here we are still having my patients, primary care doctors, say, well, you can't take testosterone because it causes cancer. No, that's not what the studies have shown. It's exactly what's been happening with hydroxychloroquine. They are and ivermectin. They're saying it doesn't work, but they're not reading the studies that show it does work.
Yeah.
And so there are a lot of parallels between the work I've been going up against.
Yeah, and then COVID.
Medical establishment.
Well, it's the pharmaceutical industry's always trying to make more billions and get more power and control things. I had a couple of thoughts and questions. Years ago, I looked into, before I became really aware of the importance of eating, I looked into the treatments for cholesterol. And I also had a friend who had written a book about it. He introduced me to the cholesterol issues. I introduced him to the psychiatric issues. Tom Moore is his name. And he found that the evidence for help from all of them was pretty much zilch. And then I looked at it again, and it looked like the only place that they got any advantage were if your levels were extraordinarily abnormal, like 400 or 500 milligrams, which most of us will never in our lifetime see. So I have avoided the statins. Oh, well, I started doing this after I took the statins and got horribly ill with aches and pains in my muscles, and nobody knew what in the world that was at the time. So what is your, do you feel comfortable talking about the risk-benefit ratio of the statins? If not, just, you know, your general impression?
Well, I think I've come to pretty much the same conclusion that you did, that I think the push, particularly in the U.S., is driving the cholesterol levels too low in ways that interfere with many other pathways in the body that where cholesterol is needed. For example, making testosterone in men, making estradiol in premenopausal women. But in addition, cholesterol is an important fat in the body that's also needed to help make myelin for brain function. So yeah. I think, like a lot of things that I see in the way that medicine has been fragmented by specialty and body part in the US, and medicine has been focused on a different medication for every symptom. And quite frankly, Americans typically want a quick fix. They don't want to eat right. They don't want to exercise. They don't want to be inconvenienced. And so a lot of people, unfortunately, have the mindset, I can eat whatever I want, and I take a pill to fix my diabetes and a pill to fix my and a pill to fix the reflux. Yeah. And we see that a lot. And I think it's multifactorial. But I also think that if that there are people with familial hyperlipidemia that, as you say, do benefit from the statins. My husband was one, but the consequences of the statins can lead to low testosterone. So his doctor, fortunately, was enlightened, and he was properly treated with testosterone therapy to offset the consequences of the statin. And I think it's a balance. That's why I think the integrated approach of the international climacteric medicine model is so important. Mm-hmm. And even though that specialty doesn't exist in the United States as one of the formal American Board of Medical Specialties, it's an important integration of the way in which our biology, our psychology, our spirituality, and our lifestyle need to all be put together. And actually, I want to show you a little diagram, which I think I can hold up and show your audience. This is what I have described over the years as the pyramid that we use in the United States, where we're trying to balance the health pyramid on the point of prescription medicines. And pyramids don't balance very well on their point. So we do something with aerobic exercise, a little bit with flexibility and weight and managing stress, but sound nutrition kind of goes by the boards with our American lifestyle. We don't tend to focus in medicine very much on the psychological importance of faith, a sense of meaning and purpose in life. And hormones are never checked except for fertility in women and erectile dysfunction in men. We never look at the metabolic effects of all of these critical hormones. So my formula, my concept, and my work has been based on getting the pyramid on its foundation, which is the way our bodies were designed, as God pointed out in Genesis 1:27 in the Bible. God said, I created male and female. And that's how our bodies are designed to work. A male body works on male physiology, and a female body is affected by the way the female body was created with the different hormone balance. Yeah. So if we get that in place, and I used to think that faith and hope and purpose was the foundation. But what I came to see over the years of working with patients is that if their hormone balance was totally out of whack, and women didn't have enough estrogen or men didn't have enough testosterone, they lost that psychological spark and resiliency that you have if your body chemistry is back to normal. So I resequenced it. And then we build the pyramid with nutrition and exercise and stress management. And then at the very top, if someone has a disease process that needs to be treated with a specific medicine, then we add the medicine systematically and appropriately, and we tailor the doses to the patient rather than just starting with these overwhelming doses where everybody gets the same dose because that's what the protocol says. It's very
wonderful. I had two other thoughts I wanted to get to. One is about the testosterone. There's lots of ads on TV. I've been looking at them. You know, take testosterone supplements, naturally developed and so on. I think it's Frank Howard. They've got him there, the big hurt, you know, advertising one of them. I forget the name of it. Is it safe for me or any other man to take these supplements? So do you have any way of giving us an estimate about that? Again, being appropriately cautious as you wish.
I don't think it is safe or reasonable to take supplements to treat a problem if you don't know what the problem is you're treating and you have no idea what's really in the supplement bottle. There is no regulatory oversight on claims that the manufacturers of these supplements make. There's no regulatory oversight on what's really in the bottle. And there's no way to determine what the negative effects may be because you don't really know for sure what's in it. So when I'm working with patients, I am looking at the importance of doing a careful assessment of what the problem is. You'll notice that some of the patients that you're familiar with that I have evaluated, I go through a pretty detailed clinical evaluation, medical history, medical records, and laboratory studies, and if appropriate, some of the imaging studies that are important. And then I put all the pieces together and I say, okay, you're low in estradiol, your thyroid pathway is not functioning properly, you're vitamin D deficient, you're zinc deficient, you may be magnesium deficient, you're low in iron stores, whatever the problems are. And then we develop a systematic way to add back what they need, whether it's nutritional supplements, whether nutraceuticals, whether it's changing the way that they eat, decreasing inflammatory foods in the diet, for example, and looking at more whole fresh foods, or whether it, and exercise and medications and how all the pieces fit together. So the other problem is that many of these supplements that are advertised to boost testosterone for men contain DHEA. And if you are over-medicating with DHEA, you may be creating the wrong kind of androgen balance that may contribute to middle body weight gain. And I think I really am concerned about the degree of the television ads, but I'm also concerned about these testosterone mills on that are popping up where men are just given testosterone injections once a month and people are not monitoring the blood counts. Right. Testosterone can stimulate red blood cell production. And actually, long before there's a risk of any concern about growth of prostate cancer, if there's an existing cancer you don't know about, long before there's any concern about effects on the prostate, the risk of blood clots causing strokes because you've overstimulated erythropoietin and men are pumping out red blood cells too fast and nobody's checking it, that's a real concern. I've had patients I've evaluated that have been getting testosterone pellets and injections and their levels are sky high. Their hemoglobin and hematocrit are sky high. Nobody had been checking it. And it is a serious risk for stroke or heart attack due to blood clot formation. So I think all of this needs to be done carefully and according to sound medical principles, which are widely available in the medical literature. But it's not a quick fix. And, you know, Dr. Bregan, I think so much of what has happened, particularly in the last 15 or 20 years, it's gotten worse. Everybody wants a quick fix. Now, some of that, I think, is due to all the supplement advertising on TV and all the pharmaceutical advertising on TV. medications are advertised, supplements are advertised, there's pill for this, pill for that,
right?
And has to do any work. And, you know, health is really something that's our greatest wealth. And just like you work at building your monetary wealth, you've got to work at building your physical health, your emotional health, your resiliency. And you need to discipline yourself to work on all of that. I have to keep up with my exercise regularly, or I have too much neck and back pain to function. And I can't just take pills and still work. So I need to do the exercise. I need to watch what I eat, because there are certain things that just create problems, and I can't do it. And the older we get, the more careful we have to be.
We have only about perhaps 2.5-3 minutes left. One comment, one question, a brief comment. You mentioned the antidepressants and sexual dysfunction very, very briefly. And I want to emphasize that that is a real serious problem for men and women. Yes. It's a big, big problem for women, but women don't get asked the details that you need to hear to find out, well, how is their sexual function, because it's so much more complicated. Whereas guys, you know, they've got this barometer, is it rising or not, guys? And and so they get asked once in a while, at least, about that. All the research shows it's sexual dysfunction very, very common with the antidepressants, especially the SSRIs. And again, don't rush to get off them. But, excuse me?
5% of patients on SSRIs long-term have sexual dysfunction, and it is horrendously serious problem for women, because it affects desire, it affects
exactly
arousal. Women have trouble having an orgasm, and then you couple that with the loss of estradiol and testosterone as they are approaching menopause, and menopausal women don't get checked for hormones, they get put on SSRIs. That was one of my early changes, because
I'm gonna interrupt, because I've got the most important thing to ask you in a minute, and then we're done. You know, obviously I agree with the doctor about all these issues that she's raising, to the extent I have the full knowledge. I don't have your knowledge even close. When you come off psychiatric drugs, I always have to put in a caveat. Don't rush to come off of psych drugs, or really any drugs, but especially psych drugs, because that's as dangerous as starting them. But consider that maybe your quality of life is down. I have a book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, still the only medical book written by a psychiatrist about these issues of withdrawing from psych drugs. Probably get that secondhand on Amazon, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. And the final question is, what's the best way for people to get in touch with you for a consultation? And we're going to end on that.
The VIVLifeCenter.com. Our website has an email that you can write for information about our new patient consults and services. I do second opinion consults for those people who have a doctor that they are working with and like, but may want some fine-tuning evaluation and treatment ideas. I just did a second opinion evaluation for a young woman in Israel having some hormone problems, and her doctor is managing the medicines, and I'm giving them recommendations for the treatment plan.
So with that, Lee, we have to end, or I wouldn't be able to get in all your minutes on the 1 hour radio show. I can extend my own video. Oh God. Dr. Elizabeth Lee Valide, whom I fondly call Valide. I don't know why, but we do when we talk about her in the house. My friend, our friend, Ginger's friend, a wonderful physician, a great doctor, and a hero, one of the heroes of what I'm now calling the refounders. We need refounders of America, And I've announced that that's what I want to be. I want to be like John Adams with Abigail Adams, Peter and Ginger Breggin, refounders of America. You are surely a refounder of America. Thank you, folks. Thank you so much for listening to us and taking us serious.